The Scotch-Irish originated from southern Scotland and northern England. They were seeking cheaper land and freedom from their Quaker leaders, many of whom considered the Scotch-Irish to be savages. In Scotland, the term hill folk referred to people who preferred isolation from greater society, and billy meant comrade or companion. Folk subcultures are emergent cultures that form out of some common situational experience, usually one that is challenging or from collective trauma. Folk subcultures are not just alternative expressions within a larger culture, but rather emerge as a response to specific circumstances that shape the identity and practice of its members. This can include experiences of geographic isolation, socioeconomic challenges, or situational shared experiences such as post-war disillusionment. How can we look at history to help us understand how situations can drive the emergent genesis of a culture? How do subcultures express their shared experiences in art and music to become part of a collective zeitgeist? Welcome to episode 8 of The Richest Family, Emergent Situational Subcultures and the Industrial Folk Phenomenon, where we discuss hillbillies, modern counterculture, and the causes for the formation of the industrial folk art experience. Hey guys.
Hey Clay.
What's up?
Jim, are you going to give us a disclaimer?
Well, you can see that I'm wearing my fake TG camouflage, so I think that we're going to have to, you know, custom tailor the disclaimer to state that we are here to break the control mechanism and dissolve all lies. No, we're not going to do that at all. What we're going to do...
We have
you
the power.
Were lying when you said that.
We have that power.
Yeah, you caught me, Greg. This was a textbook fib from the late 70s.
Excellent.
I always lie, except when I say that.
I'm just curious. I just wanted to ask this basic question of all three of us. Why are we doing this? Why do we get up on Sunday and like do all this weird? Why are we doing this? I mean, I want
to. It's a perfect way to convert nobody to what we believe.
That boogie's got a woogie.
That's right. It must. It needs to boogie. Yeah, I do it because I love spending time with you guys and you're super smart and I just, you know, it's great to share time. So we're talking about, I'm going to try to kick this one off this time. We're talking about subculture, but a little bit more than just straight up subculture. So we're not talking about like bronies, right? Like people just breaking off doing what they like, which is cool. I'm not judging bronies. But more like what happens when there's some sort of collective, like situational circumstances, and it creates some sort of shared understanding or meaning that creates a culture. It almost like it is emergent out of that. And one of these that like, you know, we always try to come to like look at history a little bit and like just like, oh, what's an example? If we're going to make some sort of thesis about today, then where does it come from? And one that popped up for me, because, you know, I'm from Tennessee and I know some of these people, is, you know, hillbillies. And you look at hillbillies and, you know, growing up in Nashville, we a lot of times made fun of them and like, totally played on the tropes and the stereotypes of what a hillbilly was. But really, these people came to America and were kind of forced into a situation of extreme poverty, isolation, cultural isolation. I mean, that's why people make jokes about them being inbred, because they were isolated. Yeah. Right. And they shared like extreme kind of trauma together, and people, they didn't want people fucking with them and people didn't want to fuck with them. And so that was kind of like
a concept.
Well, I mean, there's a little additional element. I mean, being from the Appalachian foothills of Tennessee, Johnson City. What I noticed when you start getting up into the mountains, like along the Appalachian Trail, is that there is geological isolation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
It created this whole kind of self-reliance, but also kind of antisocial behavior. Like, they didn't want lawmen up there telling them what to, they didn't.
Packs in their moonshine.
Well, it wasn't just that. They just thought of that as a culture that didn't have any relevance to them. And like, so why are you up here messing with us? Right. And we were, I mean, we made jokes about it, but everybody knew not to fuck with people from the mountains because you didn't know what they'd do. They weren't living by the structures or the cultural norms. They didn't live by our contract.
They didn't live by our contract, and they considered there's two things that come up a lot. One is revenuer, which is a generalized term for trespasser.
Right.
And because people tried to do census, right? And they didn't want to be located on the census.
Yeah, taxed.
The other thing that goes
or
on
seen,
is,
or even well, seen. It's not just the money part. It's that they don't want to operate in
inside that the machine
world.
Yeah,
they want to be off grid.
Yep.
And so,
and you're trespassing when you go there.
If you're not one of them, you are, right? And yep. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting to me, like how this becomes. I mean, snake handlers. We don't understand why they do that, but they do. And it's kind of interesting to me if we think about this and we then transpose this to, you know, other kinds, like what were the characteristics of hillbillies? Well, they made their own shit. They made their own art. They didn't have anything around them. They didn't have like people making fancy instruments. So they made them out of cigar boxes, right? Flat top guitar. It's like a whole Johnny Cash song, right? Or a bass out of a wash bin. Or, right. And so just it to me, like, let's use, is this a template? Is this, you know, when we have situations where cultures are, you know, could we define a folk, and I think folk is the key word here, a folk subculture, as a separatist, some sort of separatist culture within another culture, born out of some sort of shared situation, probably adversity. I mean, you look at outlaw bikers, I kind of see that as one. They came back from the war, they were disillusioned, they didn't have, you know, kind of the promises were not met for them, and they didn't feel like connected. They were the ones that didn't do the 1950s dream after coming back from the war. They didn't fit into that
suburb,
right? Or leather culture, gay leather culture. I mean, in the 60s and 50s, they were, you know, gay men were totally alienated for who they were, and so they created this kind of interesting, like, isolated culture of leather daddies, right? And so
trade.
or riot girls. I mean, they felt alienated from the music scene as being able to be creators, right? So they popped up, or punks, or even Zapatistas. I mean, the whole situation of the Zapatistas was that the indigenous people who had a full culture felt like they were isolated, didn't have access to resources, and they created a whole like artistic culture around it. I mean, Zapatista isn't just a political movement, it's an art and culture movement, right?
So let's talk about if we decompile when we talk about folk culture. And just change the words around a little bit and say, folk is just a generic term for people, right? and then say culture, which is a kind of grouping, right? But here's what the difference is that we have an established society, and that society has a direction that it's trying to push information, whereby folk is a generative subgroup that actually does not take from this larger group. It actually generates and
you're not
radiates
gonna see it
out.
In the gallery.
It's yeah. New. It's emergent.
It's directional, right. Directional. Yeah. Like what this yeah. is what societal is doing, is it's pressing, like arrows are coming in towards the center, and whereby folk culture is kind of generating from a point and going out. Right.
And so it's also generally solving a more immediate need without necessarily the need for a larger acceptance or response from, say, like a gallery situation.
It has no yeah. interest in that.
Yeah. Yeah. You're just making a cover for the toilet paper. You know, you're not going to put, you know, you're not expecting to sell it and it to be understood by
well, look at graffiti and the fact that, you know, this is folk art. And basically what happened was it was years before somebody said, let's take these guys and put their work, cut it off the walls even,
right,
and put it into a gallery. They had no interest in being part of that societal machine. Their interest was amongst the people that they were trying to communicate with.
What was the guy who made the stick figure dogs and dancing figures from New York?
Keith Haring.
So he started, you know, drawing these things on these, they would cover up advertisements that weren't paid for with his black wheat pasted paper. And he would draw on these things just as a convenient a canvas. And then finally, like, people were learning how to soak these things off and yep. sell them as a product. And he said, like, man, that's the reason I'm doing this. So it's just something to look at, not a product to be sold. And he stopped doing it on that because he realized, like, oh, you know, they're sort of subverting my intent.
That's right. That's right. It's the same thing as if somebody started cutting Banksy walls out and then yeah, sell yeah. them in the gallery.
Well, they right? do that.
Of course they do.
That's yeah. been, that's happened multiple times. Those have gone to auction.
Which is kind of strange that this Art Brut stuff is kind of making that full circle.
That's Art Brut.
Yeah, usually you're thinking these Art Brut things are more just serving the needs of the artist. You know, it's like an artistic kid just banging on a can, you know, because the rhythm makes him feel good. He doesn't need an audience, you know, but sure, give him an audience.
Well, right? I think that's a key aspect of folk subculture, is that yes. it's like the yes. autistic kid beating on a can. It's like having, it's being compelled to express yourself as a culture, and that is a shared expression. Instead of one individual, it's this shared expression that everybody understands and jives with. Jim, this kind of ties into how folk is a kind of a do-it-yourself. I mean, I kind of talked about that a little bit, how the Appalachians built their own instruments from what they had around them. What's your kind of perspective on do it yourself in relation to this?
Well, I mean, self-reliance seems to be a core, because we're talking about, like, once again, something that comes from a central point and then radiates outwards. And a lot of times the ad hoc or for a specific purpose, materials do not exist for your intention. And some examples of this are, you know, we have collage art that came out of, this is primarily an intersection between what would be old folk mechanicians, you know, corn husk dolls, Columbus, you know, Raggedy Ann,
monkeys.
Fetish masks from African cultures. These are all things that have specific linkages to the culture that's being generated. And they're
big, I think about things like steel drums, like, you know, industrial culture came along and there were all these 50 gallon drums around and people made steel drums and a whole culture and even an art around making those.
Okay. Drums. So let's talk about the two different directions here. You know, we had steel drums that were dumped in Jamaica, right? Like product drums and luthiers, instrument makers would take them and hammer them out and give them tonality. Whereby, you know, later on with bands like Test Department, Einstürzende Neubauten, SPK, they started just sledging on them without doing any modification, saying, we're just going to take the garbage and hammer.
Right. It was going sort of backwards. Instead of turning these things into music, they're just taking garbage cans and chunks of rebar and just, here, this one's A, this one's B, you know?
Yeah.
They're perfect just the way they are.
Yeah, that's right. Well, this is the sounds. This is the sounds of we don't want to bring an enlightenment through the sound like a steel drum in Jamaica. We want to actually let you listen to the sounds that are surrounding our existence, right? The sledging of the drop hammer in Sheffield. The other thing that was kind of interesting is, you know, people in the early industrial culture were building their own electronics. Chris Carter and Chris Watson
did a lot of that too.
And Martin Hannett.
Lloyd Rice had this thing that was so simple. It was just an electric fan
and
hooked
a
up to his guitar, so right. He didn't have to think. It's
yep. Exactly. And then there's, you know, newer guys like Author and Punisher who have mechanics. On the flip side, we have things that are kind of sitting in the middle, like Kanono Number 1 from the Congo, that make kalimbas that are amplified with homemade amplifiers.
Right.
You know, some of the other things are, you know, these guys made their own cover art, like in the industrial scene would make their own cover art. And,
show
you
me
know,
a France, man.
Yeah. And design their own logos. And so in a way, the cottage industry and the DIY aesthetic that runs all the way through it becomes very analogous to what we might have in an area of the world that has even like a cargo cult, you know? People in the Western world suddenly wearing things that are like fetish masks. That list just goes on and on.
But there was like this whole period before and around industrial that like led up to it. And I'm thinking about, you know, like William S. Burroughs and the Beat period and that kind of thing. How do you think that relates to this at all?
Oh, it completely relates to it, because basically what every folk culture kind of has a kernel that exists as a backdrop or a starting point that it unfolds from. And with the industrial culture, which I'm going to really pigeonhole that in and say that we're talking maybe 77. Some of it happens earlier, like back to even 75. But generally, its recordings are, you know, 77, 78, 79 for the early stuff. And so the proto-industrialist, I would classify as things like the futurist from Italy had sound that they were doing. The Dadaist from Zurich, Switzerland.
And we talked a little bit about that in episode 7, the futurists and how they were into dynamism and like seeing and hearing and bringing
the sounds
sound,
and
right.
The feeling of motion.
I think I've got a picture of Combe Transmissions, and there it's three people sitting down, each with a stool with a bike wheel sprouting out of it, a la what's his Marcel Duchamp?
Oh, yeah.
As if they're going right. to play them like, you know, cellos or something.
Yeah. So, exactly. And that's, you know, the industrial scene was completely coming out of the performance art scene. And yes. So we have people like Herman Nitsch in, I'm probably mispronouncing that, the Vietnamese actionist, who were insane. And some of them actually killed themselves on purpose.
Günter Brass would like cut himself man, up.
Yes. They cut themselves up. And so, you know, this kind of is the earlier side of it. And then we kind of get into what we were talking about before with the Beats and Fluxus. And Brian Gysin and William Burroughs, J.G. Ballard, and all the new wave and postmodern science fiction. These guys kind of gave, they were kind of a scene before, as well as, you know, Andy Warhol and the Factory, which I'll bring up later.
I almost included the Beats as one of the subcultures, because I think they emerged out of a lot of the same kind of post-war, like people who didn't fit into the box that
that's
everybody
right.
was
that's right.
expecting
one of, they
to
were
fit
folk,
into.
They were a folk culture.
Right.
Well, in fact, one of, music, like we say, folk music,
yeah.
Folk music is a kind of parallel running stream to the beat culture. The beat culture was a folk culture.
And I think you see this when you see a certain kind of set of art or expression emerging out of that. I think that's like a key signal that it's a folk subculture.
That's
so
right.
during this beat era, one of Frank Zappa's very first TV appearances on the Steve Allen Show. Steve Allen was a pretty sharp dude.
Oh, yeah, he talks about Edgar Varese.
Yeah, no, he was a sharp guy. And he's got this young Frank Zappa, fresh out of musical school, playing songs on bicycle parts.
That's right. That's right. That's actually a really great
You know,
clip.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, you've seen it. Yeah, it's
oh,
a great
yeah,
show.
It's classic.
You know, and Frank is looking, you know, totally prim and proper with short hair. And at first, you know, he's talking about school and theory, and then he starts playing the fucking bicycle wheel
well,
and just
yeah,
making it sing, you know?
So he's obsessed. At that point, Frank Zappa is obsessed with musique concrète and wants to be a experimental composer in the tradition of Edgar Varese, who's like kind of the father of that. So basically what we have is some other people who are very attached to that same thing, which are the Velvet Underground, Lou Reed, Andy Warhol, of course, who had the Factory.
They're
and,
bringing this fine art aesthetic into music
fine art
instead of just making love songs or something.
But then out of this, because everybody liked to say that the industrial culture was really formed musically out of a gradient between Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground and Stockhausen, there was something that came out that was a bit of a template for what was to come, and that is 1975's Lou Reed's Metal Machine Music, which is one of the most hated and loved records in history. In fact, people thought that it was just his attempt to troll the music industry. And now when people listen to it, they were like, Lou Reed was 10 years ahead of the pack. In fact, that record you could play right next to Second Annual Report by Throbbing Gristle, and mm-hmm. they live in the same universe. But then, you know, in Germany, taking things a little bit more in a very German line of thinking, shall we say, was Cluster, who were, you know, cohorts later with Brian Eno. Very heavy, very electronic. David Tudor, who was John Cage's right-hand man, huge electron, and of course Stockhausen. So this kind of is the soup that the folk culture of industrial music, I think, drew its inspiration from. Because basically all these parts were probably the same. They just didn't have a cultural identity.
Well, what I feel made that transition from the sort of like atonal sound experiments of the Beats to the like boom, 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 boom industrial thing was the influence of Taiko Dojo. because you gotta have some cardiovascular chops to bang something for 3 minutes. You do that for 60 seconds, you're out of breath. I mean, it's not just like a drum machine where
it's work.
You just hit loop and it just goes, right?
It represents the work that it represents, right? I mean, these people generally, when they played, a lot of times would be shirtless, sweating.
Zev, he was in San Francisco. He was, in my opinion, the sort of prototype that like Crash Worship and other sort of performance percussionist sort of came from. And yeah, he was a yoke guy. He was like a machinist, or you know, had some physicality to him, and his performances really showed that. You know, he was all over the place banging stuff, and he probably was that autistic kid, you know, just banging on the garbage can, and the neighbors are like, fucking Zeb, shut the fuck up already. And then, like, you saw Crash Worship, and they all talked about, like, we all were part of Taiko Dojo, and they brought those disciplines and beat patterns to their performances. But instead of these giant drums, they're hitting these pieces of metal and stuff.
Well, I know back in the day, in the 90s, everybody was crazy about watching Taiko Dojo and going to Japantown and seeing the Taiko shows, right? Jim, but you kind of alluded to, and this has been one thing you've talked to me about before, which is that industrial culture is folk culture.
Oh, yeah. It's the folk culture of a, starting with, let's kind of get the history in check, because basically you could say the thing that we call industrial culture is a product of mid to late 70s Britain. And you could go back further, you know, back to even the 60s, but you could go back further and say, a lot of people say Jack the Ripper is the start of, because he's basically a folk, you know, folk culture has its folk heroes and its folk villains. We could say the Jacks in Appalachian and Black folk culture, the tricksters and such. And in this British folk culture, we have these tricksters called Comb Transmissions, which was a performance art group that came out of kind of a folk jazz band even. They played with Hawkwind, for example. They kind of formed out of the need to create weird, surrealist art. First performance was maybe even 1966. They were definitely an offshoot of William Burroughs and Brian Gysin and the beat culture. They wanted to...
And they recognized that. They've publicly acknowledged, like, William S. Burroughs' influence, and
they hung out with him. Right. They actually cold called him up. Well, there were some other things that were kind of feeding into this mechanism as well, like Patty Hearst and
she was idealized. SLA. She was idealized for a long time. Her and all the Manson family too, in a lot of ways.
That's right.
Because Cozy was a sex worker. And she brought that into her work and made it a part of it. In fact, there was a video I was looking hard to find, and I don't even know if we'd be able to show it on some of these formats, where she's doing this intense S&M thing where she pulls this guy's balls through a piece of styrofoam, pins it out like a specimen, cuts through his scrotum, and pulls his testicle out.
Yep, that's After Cease to Exist, and that was a film. They made films, and they would occasionally stop a show. This was let's talk about that in 1 second, because basically what we ended up with is the ringleader for Comb Transmissions. You know, it was he and a group of people, including his girlfriend named Cozy Fonny Tootie. Genesis Peorage was kind of a provocateur trickster guy, and he had a friend in San Francisco named Monica Zaza, and they were doing something called mail art, where they would send art back, you know, jars full of maggots and things like that through the mail to see what they could get up away with, right? And Genesis said, hey, I've got this band because Comb Transmissions has become pure art. So we have a band now that does all the music for Comb Transmissions called Throbbing Gristle. And man, they made the headlines in Britain by basically creating a fiasco at one of the major state-run galleries. So they had a state-sponsored show, which was the first Throbbing Gristle show. They played over in a side room and had the art.
But it was performance. It was performance. Right, art. Right. It was
performance art. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. They go, hey, people love this crazy electronic music thing that we're doing. So we're going to start a label. So what's the thing? So Money Kazaza said, Genesis had said, well, we want to call it Factory Records. But then he was like, but we don't want to call it that because it sounds too much like Andy Warhol. And he said, but we really like that Andy Warhol idea of the way he makes silkscreened art, but do that silkscreened art as a music label, make our own covers, make our own logos, all this stuff. And so Money Kazaza said, well, it sounds like you just want to crank stuff out. So wouldn't that be like industrial music for industrial people, like cookie cut people? And the label stuck. So if you look up in the corner, there's a little Industrial Records Limited.
Yeah, there's like a Brutalist building.
From what a concentration camp, actually. It's not okay. Just a Brutalist building. I won't get much into that. Anyways,
they played around with Taboo. And I think that's one sort of interesting thing about Cozy Fonatuni also is, you know, in the 50s and 60s, you know, sex work was always this kind of like, you know, ultra femme, burlesque, like, you know, it was always this kind of like lingerie, pinup,
and catering to the male expectations. Yeah,
she was not that. She was
anti-stag
hardcore.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Like, here's fucking sex. Eat it. Yes. You know, she.
Well, it's from her perspective.
It was like, you know, a lot of the things that, like, the girl, you know, girl, you know, like, their ideal set, but way before it had actually come on the scene. And it had to do with, you know, the feminist movement.
Put their own priorities forward.
Right. And I think that's pretty fucking hardcore in terms of her.
Well, she said it was art. She said it was her art. And like, if we look at what this kind of folk art that they were creating, kind of the identity had things like social decay, as in we're looking at everything falling apart in this empire, right? The next one was, we're sending our art all around the world using the internet of the 1970s.
Right.
Mail. The occult, like, people were looking at them because there were still laws on the books in a lot of the colonial areas that occult practices and even information was still outlawed. Yep. They were interested in uncovering information about things like, did you know that Ford was involved in Nazi atrocities as well as IBM? They were making the most extreme electronic sounds because punk rock had just come on the block and they wanted to upstage punk rock. Outsider art and art brut, because they were saying, like, why is art a profession, right? This is not.
And that's connected back to Dadaism, and they're kind of like.
Well, even the Dadaists were sort of trying to be professional artists. They were saying, why is art a profession? Why isn't, you know, this kid's popsicle stick art as good as the Mona Lisa? And I just want to kind of go and gloss over really quickly the players. So the first players on the scene, there a lot of these guys were doing stuff at the same time, if not, like, you know, Cabaret Voltaire going back almost to the 60s, right? And Throbbing Gristle and Comb Transmission, as Comb Transmissions going back.
They were always creative people.
Yeah, so one of the things that happens is you have TG who set up a label, Industrial Records, Cabaret Voltaire coming out of Sheffield, Boyd Rice in San Francisco, and LA, SBK in Australia, Monica
Rough Trade.
Zaza in San Francisco, Joanna Wendt, who, when we're talking about the culture, was doing music, but was also making incredible costumes. Not Humans, Rhythm and Noise, which was a venue slash event slash a lot of his stuff. They became a Recombinant Media Lab and were as interested in video as they were in audio. He called it Vaudio back in those days.
Well, that's what I liked about them is it became way tighter technically. It wasn't just clunk clunk on a metal can. There's people actually using software and editing
Oh
and getting
yeah.
technical with it,
Oh yeah. Zeph, who talked about his integration with Jewish mysticism and tribalism in the Kabbalah and how that integrated into his noise. Survival Research Laboratories, who were not really doing music per se.
One of the things when I was coming up and I was like listening to SBK and Current 93 and all this, wacky shit, and I saw the Industrial Culture Handbook, and it was kind of like this gateway drug, right? And I know Vail now and like have hung out with him a ton of times, but then I had no idea. This was just like this virus being injected into my brain, and seeing that book, and then subsequently buying the videos. And it really, Greg, it turned me on to you too in a lot of ways. I mean, this is how we all got connected. Can we talk a little? Do either of you know how Vail kind of got onto the track with the Industrial Culture Handbook? And like,
Yeah.
I've never asked him that,
He
even
was
though I've
on
hung
the
out with him.
ground floor with everything because he was doing Seek and Destroy
Oh, Search and
before,
Destroy,
or
yeah.
Search and Destroy,
And
which was kind of.
pranks. He did pranks before they were on YouTube. He did a whole thing on.
That's Incredibly
But
Strange
that's way
Films.
later on,
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. The original stuff was he had Search and Destroy, which is his punk zine that did have industrial bands in it. But then he had a tablet. Remember, these are tabloids. They're not
Yeah,
like,
it's a
they look like
newspaper. It's a
newspapers.
newspaper. Yeah, they're
Yeah.
not meant to be saved, unlike the research books.
And so a lot of these articles that he had were the bedrock, kind of the formatting for the interviews. Like he had interviewed people for the earlier tabloids and then tabloid issues of Search Research and Search and Destroy, and then had kind of redone those interviews or even maybe added them into the Industrial Culture Handbook, which was more like almost like a compilation and saying all these bands had similarities.
We talk about like how the industrial culture is sort of springing from beatnik culture. Vail lives right around the corner from the Condor. He lives a stone's throw from what's the bookstore? The beatnik
City
bookstore.
Lights.
City Lights,
City
City
Lights.
Lights.
He must
So
he lives over in North
Yeah,
North
so
Beach. North
yeah,
Beach,
so
yeah.
the heart
Where
of
the Beats were.
the heart of Beatnik Land is his home. So as he's, drawing these different inspirations for his publications, everything's being filtered through that. He's sitting in cafe floor while editing this stuff, right?
Oh, he worked back in the okay, some history about Vail that's interesting. If we know about the band, kind of the proto grunge 60s band Blue Cheer, Vail was actually the keyboard player
Nice.
before.
Does he have long hair?
Oh,
Nice.
he was the
Yeah,
keyboard
yeah,
player,
yeah.
and then the band went to see Hendrix at the Monterey Pop Festival and came back and said, "Oh, we want to be a three piece." He said, I don't really blame them. Anyways, so you know, Vail has a lot of interesting history, but one of the things that happens is that he becomes he works at City Lights back in the day. Mm-hmm. And so he's definitely part of he's, you know, was really interested in protest music and the blues and that kind of stuff. And it seemed like punk rock to him and industrial culture were extensions in some ways of the same thing that was going on with protest music and with other folk music and blues.
That's a differentiation I see between industrial culture and just sort of regular punk culture is the literary aspect.
Absolutely.
Almost to a person, anyone you meet who was into industrial music also had this literary background of these things that led to these conclusions, as opposed to just drunken teenagers who like to jump off stuff.
Well, just to look at in the industrial culture handbook, Vail does something very interesting, and I've told him this on numerous occasions, that I think one of the most industrial culture things that exist is the list, right? Because in every chapter in the industrial culture handbook, there's a compilation of list for every artist that's in there, so that you can read what they read and you can watch what they watch and you can listen to what they listen to.
Yes.
Right. And so this idea that, in not some kind of cliched way, but in some kind of very interesting, focused way, that they're giving you the blueprints.
They're giving you the formula.
They're giving you the formula.
Not just telling you to eat their opinion, but giving you the tools to form your own conclusions.
Hopefully, well, to be influenced by the same virus, to be have the virus injected into your brain.
Oh, to make your own virus.
Yeah. Whatever. I'm seeing some stuff on SPK here, and we haven't talked too much about SPK and their relevance to this.
Yeah, they went through an interesting transition where they really start, like, you know, the guy, Graham Revell, is really an amazing, talented artist, was a medical student, worked at a mental hospital. And some of his early films are incredibly hard to watch. I mean, they're like taking corpses and making them into puppets and stuff. And some of the people involved in these early SDK performances were definitely, you know, career criminals, mental asylum patients.
Oh, Neil Hill, for example, who was a patient that Graham had met.
They were some rough people, yeah.
Yep. And Dom is the guy, I guess, who was making the films.
But,
you know,
but so clearly, this is coming from maybe some different vectors than, like, home transmissions, the SPK, that they had their own, but somehow there
it's
was
also Australian,
right?
Right.
So,
right.
How did all this get synced up? I mean, was it just that there were undercurrents going on in Western civilization at the time that were common, or
well, they're obviously influencing one another, because you look at some of the early SPK performances and you look at some of the early Einstürzende Neubauten performances. They both got the power sauce, the sledgehammers, and they've usually got some kind of electronics going on, someone singing, and then a couple of guys swinging shit around and breaking shit on stage.
Well, with SPK, you also have something that's very strange in that their name, Socialist Patients Collective, were a terrorist organization, the Badr Meinhof group, offshoot of the Badr Meinhof group over in Germany. And they were actually, the SPK were actually mental patients that had decided that they wanted to cause a revolution. And their motto was kill, kill, kill for mental health. Right. Or, you know, inner peace or whatever. And so this is the interesting thing, is that if you look at what is going on folk culture wise inside of SPK, you have costumes that are basically like Ned Kelly. If you know who Ned Kelly, he's like the Australian Iron Man super.
Yes,
villain.
The Buckethead. Yeah,
yeah. He wore like a
huge iron suit, and he was a gigantic person too.
Yeah, so
but there were a couple versions of him. Yeah, please go on. Yeah.
Yeah, they have the imagery of Ned Kelly, and that was something else. They were all anonymous earlier on, had fake names, and this stuff, remember, is kind of generated. All these bands, like in San Francisco and England and
There was the legally
Sydney,
dubious
Australia.
aspect.
They're all kind of
Right.
coming to the same place in different spots in isolation.
I also like this idea of we're inside of this culture and we're hacking it. Like you said that yourself, like this do it yourself, and we're going to use the mail to send maggots. We're going to go find junk and build art, like survival research laboratories. You know, this idea that we can exist as a culture, our own culture, on the dog's tasty lunch, you know,
Yeah,
Rome.
repurposing the detritus.
In Rome,
Yes.
the dogs would go to where people like had excess and would eat and live off of the excess of Rome. That's what these cultures are doing. They're saying we're autonomous. We live inside. We built it because your culture isn't working for us, and we're going to go make crazy machine sex art like survival research laboratories in the face of that. So, Greg, you did a little collection here on survival research laboratories. You know, we all in the 90s, we got to see the fire and the fire marshals trying to shut down the shows, calling Mark Pauline a terrorist and all of this kind of stuff. What are your thoughts on survival research laboratories?
You know, they were just the most grassroots things you could find. The only advertisements you had for these things were these wheat pasted posters, and I posted a couple of them there that you would find in the most inhospitable parts of town, underneath freeways, next to, you know, some greasy homeless encampment. Although, of course, at that period of time, there weren't that many. So the only way you even knew about it is if you walked into these unsavory parts of town. You know, there was no ads in the newspaper, no radio spots. You looked at, you know, the normal place where you find for music venues, no mention of it at all. And, you know, maybe you'd have to go to, you know, like a record shop to buy the tickets. But that was the only way you found out about it. And, you know, and the names of these events sound just like some suicide cult. You
Extremely cruel practices, a series of events designed to instruct those interested in policies that correct or punish.
know? The fact that they had a formula that had a simple and then a complex
Well,
nomenclature.
usually what they'd like to do was to find some aesthetic that was completely opposite of what they were saying, that was like old and fucking played like chick comics. You know,
Yep.
okay, Davey, let's be Christian and throw that punk rock shit
Chick
away.
tracks, right?
Right.
That's what,
And they would
yeah.
take that shit and reword it and be like, okay, Jimmy, throw your crucifix in the toilet, you know, and make some, you know, altered version, but using the format of the old played message.
That's a viral, that is kind of the definition of virus, is hijacking a system and then using it to propagate your own information,
Like one
right?
thing that Mark Pauline did a lot was altering billboards. I've got a picture on
Yeah.
my vision board there, and he would just take overall, paint the logo of the sign company on and do it in the middle of the day, and
Yep.
not even make like it was a crime, you
Hacking.
know.
What was it?
And
The Billboard Liberation Front is, I
yeah.
believe, what he called himself.
Yeah. And he said one time a cop said, like, what are you doing? Be like, I don't know. They hired me to do this. It's some crazy shit. Who knows, right?
He
You
was
know?
crazy like that. He got,
Yeah.
I went to France with Survival Research
Oh,
Laboratory and did all
cool.
the firing on the
Oh,
inchworm.
very nice.
And I'm going to transition here. I have a funny story to tell. So when we first showed up, the French artists loved us. I mean, they were like, we were getting, you know, fancy fresh bread. We were getting great food. You know, they loved us. And like it took us about a week and a half to set this show up. And we were just struggling to get stuff. And like there were things that happened where the like we had to like take a couple of things that maybe we shouldn't have in order to get the show up. And it we ended up pissing off the French major, the people who were hosting us. And by the end, the food was stale. Weren't getting as much. The water heaters had been turned off.
Not quite as hospitable.
Oh no, it was hardcore. It was a really that was one of the most hardcore shows for Survival Research Laboratories. I didn't go forward, but there was a in Graz, there was a really big accident when one person got hit by a machine. And it caused permanent brain damage. Really, really great
Oh
guy it happened
shit.
to. There
Oh
was a big
man.
fundraiser for him. But I mean, those fucking machines are dangerous. They
Yes,
are
you don't
basically
sit in the fucking front row.
they're
Don't sit in the
construction
front row.
equipment that has been turned into art, is what they fucking are. And I know it
Eye,
because I
ear, and
wired it.
lung protection.
Yeah.
When you go, you want
So
earplugs, eye protection, ear protection, mouth protection. Who knows what sort of crazy gases they're giving
oh man, I
off?
almost lost my hearing. They had an like a compressed cannon or a jet
Dude.
engine, and I had no idea it was going to be that loud. And basically, I thought I was permanently deaf.
Well, most of the shows are outside, or maybe under a ledge. But
That
I saw them at on Broadway, with
Oh, yeah.
Einstürzende Neubauten playing, and SRL was the headliner. In fact, I've got video I posted up on as one of the attachments. And for one thing, you're seeing things much clearer because you've actually got theatrical lights. And I was right on the front line, and the shit's falling off fucking stage with metal spikes and, animal corpses attached to this. Everyone on the front line is like, whoo, go, like a fucking rugby team with this fucking rotting corpse of a machine.
I mean, they integrated like dead rabbits and like carcasses
Yes,
around
yes.
and dogs on
And the
all the
video is pretty
time.
clear. The video is pretty clear.
Yeah. So, do we want to wrap up with anything here? Is there any kind of parting thoughts that we'd like to share before we wrap this up?
Well, I like to say that it existed in a point in time. I think if that were to happen nowadays, it would not happen because we've got the internet, we've got computers, and I think a lot of the concepts that were played with was this transition from the purely physical to the digital. And I
Interesting.
like how a lot of these artists have made that complete transition. I think we talked
What
about
does
Grammar
a
Bell.
digital folk subculture look like? Like one where we've transcended into the internet-worked world we live in now. What does that look like?
I look at some of these AI fakes, and that's what I think is stirring the shit up. I see people doing crazy subversive shit with AI, and these fucking regular people are just not ready for it, man. They're going to be fumbling and yelling and pointing at something that isn't there.
I think that now basically a lot of the stuff that we're talking about as a culture is now something that could be a filter, an action filter in Photoshop, or an action filter inside of a audio program.
I'm wondering whether, like, when you talk, Greg, about AIs being the force in a subculture, like, I was just thinking this today. What if you look at, like, let's say ChatGPT-3, and you go, I don't agree with how it answers. And so, as a subculture, we're going to take our belief system and our perspective. And we're going to train our own AI. We're going to, just like SRL went and used the Obtainium of the things around them, but to make a new vision. I think these new subcultures will build their own knowledge systems and build their own networks of communication on top of the existing ones. And that to me is in the spirit of folk art. Taking what's there, reinterpreting it, and reemerging. And it's going to be somebody who's fucking pissed off. at the world, or because it's marginalized them in some major way, a group of people, and they're going to express themselves with their own art and creativity.
Well, even an angle that I don't want to get too strongly into now is the power of disinformation as a weapon that I feel the American culture is at a constant onslaught of this. That it's not just a matter of just a few disenfranchised individuals, that you have psychology professors in Russia who work for the intelligence, whose job is to specifically make memes that.
Not just on their side, though. If you look at
Yes, yes, yes.
the sta if you look at the standard media, like look at something like MSNBC, and you look at how much of that is Cold War
Yes,
provocation,
precisely,
and basically
precisely.
like Putin is losing his shit. I'm just like, this is not real information. What it is
Emotion,
not it's
emotion.
what's the term for it? Agroprop, aggravational propaganda.
It's their
Agitprop.
propaganda. As a fucking Fox
But
News is, right?
guys.
We're tangenting.
No,
This is the
yeah.
show. This is another
Let me
show.
wait, listen
Yes.
for just for a second. Subcultures are about truth, not what the mainstream is trying to tell you. It is an emergent group that understands some truth and builds a culture around it, and it's counterculture. And so what you're talking about, Greg, is the mainstream culture. This disinformation stuff and like all of this, and Jim, what you're talking about, and Putin is this or that. These subcultures are gonna fucking shed that shit off like
Yes.
it's a dirty coat. And
Well,
they're gonna
we.
make their own new thing based in their truth, but using these same technologies.
Oh,
That's what I think.
yeah. Yeah,
That's what I
sure.
think the future is. They will take AI, they'll take all the networking that that our main culture is, and hijack it and reuse it.
Well, that's why I think at this level, when things are silly, people's faces are melting and have 11 fingers, it's important to view this stuff and have it as part of your lexicon. But these people who like reject all AI, when that shit becomes tight, they won't even see it, man. They'll just be dishing out their money and their vote completely uncritical because they won't see the glowy line that shows it's a blue screen.
And
It's already blurring.
that's where I think the subcultures are going to combat that with truth. Okay, I want to cut off there. I'll get to take the last word. And I just want to tell you guys what a pleasure it is to be able to do this with both of you. What a privilege. I'm so grateful, and I love you both.
I
And
had so much fun, guys. I love hanging out and
take care,
shooting the shit.
guys. And we'll see you in the future. Much love.
All right,
Yeah.
guys. Love you. See you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another amazing episode of The Richest Family. We hope that it made you think about weird stuff or at least reconsider something you felt like you already knew. You can watch the video recording of this podcast on YouTube at youtube.com/@ClayTantor. It really helps us grow the channel by liking and subscribing. Or you can watch a stream live on twitch.tv/ClayTantor every other Sunday at 10 a.m. PST. Thanks again, glad you're here, and have a strange and interesting day.